Welcome to Limited Time Only.
I'm Esther.
And I'm Susie.
Limited Time Only is the podcast for anyone who feels there aren't enough hours in their life.
And each week, there's a different topic for you to get your ears around.
Featuring chat, comedy sketches, and interviews with interesting people.
Limited Time Only is a pick-me-up in podcast form.
The special guest later in the episode is Jesse Quinn from Keen. This week, it's time for Everybody's Changing. Everybody's changing and I don't feel the same.
And we're back.
Okay, so basically, no, hang on a second. There's something funny about my hair. Hang on. No. I thought something funny had gone on with my hair, but I think it's fine.
Oh, like a widow's peak or something?
Yes, I think it just developed one.
My gran's got, actually, no, my gran doesn't have a widow's peak because she's very dead.
Oh, she probably still got one somewhere.
Actually, do you know, it's weird that you say that because last night I did a breathwork session with Guru Sue.
And you saw your nan?
Kind of. It was really weird. I always have, as I've spoken before about in the podcast, massive, major releases. I always let go of something and I don't always know what it is.
Last night it was wind.
Last night it was like bloody Doctor Who. I got this when he regenerates, because I got this feeling and it rose up my body and I was literally physically shaking and couldn't stop, and my teeth were chattering and I was all over the shop, and then it came up into my throat and jaw and it got stuck and it was all really tense and it was burning and it was painful and it wasn't moving. And Sue has this instinct where she comes over and just knows something's going on for you, and she came over and she touched my throat and she started tapping on the front of my chest and then it released. But I was like Doctor Who, my head went back, I let out this huge sort of scream and like a scream and a cry, and I sobbed for about 2 or 3 minutes and then I was completely calm and it was gone. I don't know what it was.
I mean, Doctor Who, I'm going exorcist. I'm not getting a Doctor Who vibe there.
Well, you know, when he regenerates, David Tennant chucks his head back.
Oh, no, I've not really watched it very much. Sorry, David.
Oh, David's the best one. I know. Something left me and I don't know what it was, but apparently the shaking is trauma. And it just came up, rose up my body and then left me. And it was, I don't know what it was, but I feel very zen. But back to my dead grandmother.
Yeah, so how did she come into it?
So
God, where's Yvette Fieldy when we need her? Come on.
Right. Derek Acora. Come in, Derek Acora, wherever
all right,
you are.
So, Esther, what's going on?
Bring my gran and let's chat about it, because he's gone as well, hasn't he?
But, has he? What? Where was he? Sorry, I'm stutter-tastic today. Where was he from?
No, he's dead. I don't know where he is now.
Was he from Liverpool? Or where was he from, Derek Acora?
I think he might have been from Liverpool.
Okay, yeah. Right. So, Esther, I want you to tell me what happened at the breathwork session with your nan and a widow's peak. I'm Derek Acora.
Well, bring her in, Derek. She'll tell you.
All right, Derek. I've gone different part of north, the north
and
now.
My gran was from the north, but she didn't have much of an accent, but she would come in and, anyway. She'd sit with a fag and go, oh, Derek. Anyway, so what happened was,
yeah.
I had this big sort of release, and then I was sort of having all these weird little visions, and I felt amazing. But then suddenly I saw my mum, my gran, my auntie Wendy, who died last year, and my grandpa in the distance, and they were in front of me, and they just went, why are you so scared about dying? Because when you die, we're here. And I went, oh, yeah. And then I felt like, oh, I don't feel like I'm that scared of dying anymore. And it was really...
What, and has that lasted till today?
Yes. I mean, it'll probably come back, but hopefully not.
Well, that's absolutely... Sorry, I'm fiddling with something, so I'm going to stop fiddling, well, otherwise you can't...
We're working, Suze. It's a time and a place, love.
It's Friday. I think that is amazing,
yeah,
Esther.
It is.
That's so cool and lovely. I just imagine your family sort of standing there waving at you.
Yeah.
Or beckoning. Just don't go yet, Esther.
Not yet.
You just hold off another, I don't know, 55 years?
Yeah, 55.
Because
yeah.
I'm aiming for that.
Yeah, 101. No,
is
hang
that,
on.
Is that all? No, more than that.
55 years? Oh, yeah. My brain's not braining.
I can't count either, but it's more than 100.
Well, when this episode goes out, I'll be 46. So in fact, this is our first episode because this might be my birthday.
Would be apt, wouldn't it?
It would be apt.
And unless you're Shakespeare. Shakespeare died on his birthday. We're not talking about that. We're not. You're totally fine.
Oh, God. What if I die today, Susie? Oh, well, I've had fun anyway.
You've had fun and you've managed to record this bit. So
yeah,
I'm okay because I've got a little bit, you know.
Yeah, you can
a little bit in the can,
on.
Like Oliver Reed in Gladiator. I'll record as much as possible.
Who died on my birthday?
You're not. Esther, listeners, Esther is not dead.
Oh, God, I hope not.
Oh, my God, I don't like this anymore.
No, I don't like this. We might need to move on. I'm just going to Google when Oliver Reed died. No, yes, 2nd of May, 1999.
Are you joking?
No, I knew
Are
that.
Are you actually joking?
No.
Oh, my. What the... Derek,
my 21st Derek. Birthday.
Hey, girls, what are you talking about? I don't think you should talk anymore about this.
Not ready
that,
yet,
that
Derek.
Is the weirdest. This whole section.
Oh God,
I love it. I think this is possibly the best thing we've ever recorded.
I think so too, and I think we should stop because I'm scared we're going to kill me.
Completely off the cuff, and yeah, all right.
55 years, Suze will be 101.
Well, it's good. Well, I am actually aiming for 104, but okay. So my maths is a bit out, but my body's going to go on.
Yes, like your heart. Like
my heart will go on, even if my arithmetic abilities have died.
Suze, can we start the meeting now? We've been sat here for 20 minutes.
Sorry, I can't decide which of my Bright Disposition notebooks to use. Do I want to dream big and go for my dreamy navy blue notebook? Or do I want to shine bright with a notebook in luscious bright pink, LTO colours?
They're beautiful, but why have you got five?
They all made me so happy I had to buy the full range. Plus, I'm down with the company ethos. Bright Disposition is a small family business and each notebook has been designed with love.
Let me have a look.
Here you go.
Ooh. A hard-wearing cover, gorgeous colours, a lovely band to keep them shut, a ribbon to keep your place.
And top-quality paper that my pen glides over and doesn't seep through. I think I'm in love. Okay, I'm feeling sunny, so I'm going for the sky blue. We can start the meeting now, Esther. Esther!
Oh, sorry. I'm just on Etsy ordering stationery from Bright Disposition. There's an LTO discount code for 10% off. I'll be with you in a mo.
No rush. I'm stroking my notebooks.
Bright Disposition. Uplifting gifts to encourage and inspire you. Available from Etsy. And for LTO listeners, there's 10% off. Just use the code LTO10 at checkout. If Susie and Est haven't bought them all already. Mum, there's another big box from Bright Disposition here.
We wanted this episode to be called Everybody's Changing. For multiple reasons, actually. But one of them is that it is spring.
Yay! I love spring.
I love spring. And it is a relief, isn't it? It's a genuine relief.
Do you know what? As I said at the beginning of season three, I love autumn. Cozy, yes. Opaque tights, stews, blah, blah, blah. And I think, oh, autumn's my favourite. And then we get to spring and I go, no. It's spring.
Yeah.
Bluebells, lovely flowers smelling, the sound of a lawnmower, just daylight. Oh, love it.
Yes. The mood has immediately lifted. It just feels easier.
Yeah.
The light. Yeah, getting up is easier. Getting up in the morning is so much easier in the spring.
And you've got so many more hours. So I walk my dog for about an hour to an hour and a half every day. But during the winter months, I can walk her between about 9 and 3. And that's it. That's my window of opportunity because I just can't. It's too dark. I don't want to walk on my own during the dark hours. So, but spring, I mean, I can be rocking a walk at 8 o'clock. I mean, it's very liberating. Very liberating.
Well, I've been running. And also, I've recently seen lots of bluebells.
Yes, I love a bluebell.
And I also did a little bit of gardening the other day, which I haven't done for about a year. So that's the spring effect.
But do you find, because I do, that we get to spring and I think, right, what do I need to plant? And everyone says, oh, you should have planted it all in the winter. And I go, oh, another year gone.
Yes.
I still don't know what
just
I'm doing.
Just the weeds then. No, I've no idea. I can pull out, but I've no idea about putting back in. I can pull out. Pull out.
As the bishop said to the actress.
We wanted to call it Everything's Changing, partly because to talk about the spring, didn't we? But also partly because... of the change. the change.
Well, I was thinking about you moving.
Well, so there's that as well, but I think that's all part of it. So, yes. So there's the change of life. Yeah. I mean, for women, the menopause, which can start, well, can start...
In your 30s.
In your 30s. But it's definitely kicked in, hasn't it, for us?
Well, I don't know if it has. I mean, I don't want to go too much. I don't know if it has. I had some eczema flare-ups last year and I had a few nights where I was overheating and then they were triggering eczema. And so they gave me a very low dose of HRT. Apart from that, I haven't noticed anything else. But it's sort of at varying degrees with all of my friends. I'm probably, yeah, at the beginning.
Yeah, which is actually a normal kind of normal age. I mean, I think I'm slightly further ahead than you, but I am 2 months older. So,
Well, that makes all the difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Where will I be in 2 months, Suze? Tell me what's going to happen to me.
I think I'm slightly early. I think I'm slightly early with it all, but certainly things are changing. But just aging, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
And kind of,
yeah.
We are in the middle years, as someone I know calls them, rather than middle age. I think the middle is quite nice.
Yes.
It's like Malcolm in the middle.
Yeah.
Susie and Esther in the middle.
When I was younger, I think I had a preconceived idea about how I would age, what I would look like, and that I would just be this fabulous older woman that just looked amazing. And now I'm like, oh, actually, you don't really have any control. You've just got to try and exercise quite a lot, really reduce how much you eat. And seeing my face change, I actually find quite challenging. I thought I'd be really cool with it. And then I'm like, oh, look at my neck. And then look at this. And
oh, it's awful.
It's really distressing.
It's quite weird, isn't it? Because it's like when you know a child, one of your friend's kids or whatever, and you don't see them for a few months,
yes,
or a year or whatever.
Yeah.
And they've changed so much.
Yeah.
And obviously with your own kids, you don't really notice it. I mean, I look at pictures and go, oh my gosh, yes, you've changed vastly in the last, I don't know, even 6 months with my daughter particularly. And you don't notice it because it's ongoing and you see them every single day. And with friends as well, I think I don't really... I notice a bit, but if I'm seeing them fairly regularly, I don't notice. But then, of course, when you look in your own mirror, you're not looking in your mirror all day long. So I kind of have a horrible shock at the end of every day when I'm cleaning my teeth. I'm like, oh my God, what's happened to the jowls riddle?
And don't you think as well, sort of, I feel that the last 10 or so years my face has changed quite a bit.
I feel so.
But what happens is I'll go, oh my God, every day my face looks slightly different or slightly changed. And then I kind of get used to that face. And then about 3 months later, it happens again. And it's sort of like constantly readjusting. Like, oh, I don't know if this way I do my makeup works anymore. And I've got to suddenly change it. And oh, I just thought I'd be really cool with it. I just thought I'd be like yeah, I'm going to be, well, not Nigella, because obviously Nigella has a little bit of help. And actually, Helen Mirren looks fabulous, but she has a bit of help as well. But I thought I'd be, you know, like somebody like that. And now I'm like, oh God, I think I might just be turning into a blob.
I think it is quite shocking. And obviously you have to say, well, you've got to accept. But
yes.
I think it's hard because your face is fairly the same from, I don't know, for like 20 years. Obviously you do look a bit older, age like 21 to 35, but the elasticity of the skin and
yes,
and wrinkle, I mean, I think it is quite a shocking change.
Do you know what I'm really grateful about is that I got together with my husband when I was 18, because I don't think he sees a change in me. We'll say things and I'll go, oh my God, you know, look at, and he'll be like, oh no, you look lovely. And then I'll show him the photograph or the video and you can see him go, oh yeah. He still sees me. Like, he's always hugely supportive. He's so lovely. But we got together at 18, so I think in his head I'm still 18, which is amazing.
No. I also think that there's a difference when you have children. I think children need you. So anyone thinking about it, think very carefully.
Well, do you know what though? When I had my kids, I don't think I've ever looked better.
Oh, you were all right. Yeah, I think.
But I was 28 and 30 when I had my kids.
Yeah, and I was like 36 and 40.
Yeah. It's a bit different.
Maybe that is rubbish. Maybe I would have just aged exactly the same if I had kids or not. Although I would have had more sleep in the intervening years. But
yeah.
The other thing is COVID, I think, was aging. You know, people aged quite dramatically over a course of a couple of years, I think, through worry and sort of being inside and the stress. But I say that, you know, before COVID, there was this version of myself, like Susie 1.0. And then after, like now, it's Susie 2.0. Because it's like, what the hell happened? So I think the menopause is having a huge effect on me as well. And also, I mean, I said to you the other day, I think I'm having a midlife crisis, but you kindly reframed that as a midlife rebirth.
Yeah.
Which kind of sounds a bit messy, but...
I had a conversation with a friend of, and he was saying, I think you get to a certain age, which is very much what I think as well. And it's about letting go of all the layers that you've put on yourself through your life to become somebody that you think is socially acceptable. And then you get older and you go, actually, that's not really who I am. I'm just going to drop that. And actually, that's not really who I am. So I'm just going to drop that. Or actually, I've changed a bit as well. And I think getting to this age is sort of getting back to the core of who you are. And it's sort of about being more authentic.
Yes. It's quite funny because I think in the last few months, I've had real strong sort of revelations about who I am and also about my reactions to situations, some relationships with people I've known for years. I mean, like family members, friends, how they react. I've sort of suddenly become more aware in a way. But is that, do you think that's because of sort of sitting more comfortably in myself that I can go, well, this is how I react to things? And because I've been reacting to things for 46 years. So I've kind of got a handle a bit on how I react to things. And I think it's made me more, it's made me both more and less tolerant.
Yes.
It's made me more tolerant of friends and family and less tolerant of any fuckwits out on the street. So don't, I mean, I terrify myself sometimes. There was a couple the other day who, and I was parking, I'd reversed into our drive and hadn't quite got it right. So I was trying to, I was waiting for traffic to pass so I could straighten up and come back in again. And this couple crossed the road. And then while I was obstructing the entire pavement, so they would have had to walk right into my drive to get around the car. Rather than just waiting, they started to try and walk behind the car.
Oh God.
And I just went, oh wait, just wait. I'm trying to reverse. Just wait. And they dutifully stopped and I reversed. But I was like, just don't. Don't. And I thought, God, if I was them, I would have been a bit terrified of this crazy woman. I mean, I wasn't in the best mood anyway.
Don't mess with a menopausal woman.
Normally, I would sort of feel quite shaken afterwards and, I don't know, like, oh, I wish I'd said this, I wish I'd said that. I was like, no, I feel I'm completely calm. I mean, it could be the antidepressants, but I feel completely and utterly justified. And yeah, absolutely won't be taking any crap anymore.
I think that's something that definitely comes with age. I struggled a lot with my mental health in my 20s and I had a full-on nervous breakdown in my early 20s, which was just a hangover from loads of things that went on in my childhood. Yeah. And it was horrendous when I was in it. It was absolutely horrendous. But consequently, I'm very analytical of myself and others. But I mean, it's quite self-absorbed, really, isn't it? I'm always sort of trying to understand. So talking about aging and, oh, hang on, I'm going to have to really start exercising and I'm going to have to really start being very careful about what I eat. And actually, I'm angry about that. I feel petulant. And that is not an adult response. That is almost like a stroppy toddler that's going on there. That's like, I don't want to. I want to eat a McDonald's and I want to stuff my face and I don't want to have to go and do any exercise because I should just be able to look lovely without having to do it. It's sort of, I think you get to a point in your life where you go, okay, so right, that is about 5-year-old Esther and she's kicking off. And so it's that awareness. And then with other people going, okay, that's not about me, that's about them and that's their toddler. And then also, I suppose for me, I'm becoming far more boundaried because I'm so prone to burning out. I'm so prone to overwhelming myself and just then not being able to function. So I'm really quite structured with that. But I think that's come with age for me. Mm. You think of batty old people, don't you? Like the angry old guy at the corner of the road or whatever. Yeah. But I think it is just going, I'm not putting up with this shit anymore.
Well, yes. And you know, there's a lot of people who want to take advantage. I don't think the couple trying to cross behind my car were, but they were just being quite selfish and making themselves slightly unsafe as well by getting in my way.
Get out of my way, you bastards!
Would the owner of the self-esteem left behind in the mid-90s please come and collect it? It's your time. Thank you.
I was in a coffee shop with my friend the other week and the staff all kept looking at us, but no one spoke to us for over 5 minutes. And I find that really infuriating.
That's happening more, I think. And I think that is, unfortunately, something that will happen increasingly.
Yeah, just give me a nod. Like, just, it doesn't take 2 seconds. But they all just kept looking at me and walking past, and I was like, I'm sorry. Am I coming in here to spend my money? Or, I mean, this is turning into an episode of Grumpy Old Women now, isn't it? But
so part of my midlife rebirth.
Yes,
I've got my ears pierced. I did have them pierced before, but I've had them re-pierced because they'd sort of covered over.
Okay. Your holes are closed.
My holes are shut tight.
Closed for business.
Closed for business. I am obviously doing my running. And also, I'd like to get a Ferrari and date younger women. No.
younger women.
No. And the other thing is, we are moving to Hove. Actually.
How exciting. Hove, actually.
So I just want to be, I want to have purple hair and sea swim every day.
What's that poem? When I'm old, I shall wear purple. That's a lovely poem.
I like the song.
Yes, that'll be you.
I'm wearing purple, wearing purple.
I don't know that song.
I'll find it.
Yeah. I mean, have you made it up or is it?
No.
I'm going to make a note of it. Wearing purple.
Something about purple. Is it true, guys? Is it a fever dream?
Was it a... Yeah, I was going to say, was it a fever
dream? No, it's something about wearing purple. Yeah, yeah, I'll find it. I'll find it.
It's very exciting, though, that you're moving to the seaside. And so you're off to Hove.
Yes, it's very exciting. We found somewhere to rent. We're going to rent our house out because we don't want to buy straight away because we don't know it well enough to kind of do that. Yeah. We just want to test it out as well because it is a big change. We've got places at schools for the kids. Someone came to take photos of the house yesterday and... And it is weird. It's that sort of, oh, but it is a lovely house.
This is real.
But I think that's normal.
It's like, Sue, that's like when you go to get your hair cut and you think, I'm going to have a totally new haircut. And then the day before, your hair looks incredible. And you go, oh, shit, what am I doing? That's all that is. It's just normal.
Yeah, I think it is normal. And I'm reading a wonderful book about the sea, about women in the sea. Lots of poetry and sea shanties. And it's called Salt on Your Tongue by Charlotte Runcie. It's a really brilliant book, I think, for anybody. But if you have a sort of anchoring,
a hankering
for the sea, then it's you'd love it actually, Esther. You'd love this book. So I'll give it to you when I've finished it.
Thank you. I've just written it down.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I'm reading that very quickly and just trying to look at lots of pictures of the sea and remember how I feel by looking at pictures of me by the sea. I said to Joel. The other day I was like, I do hope I'm not sort of dragging you all down there as a result of my midlife crisis. But I think everyone's super keen, including the kids. And if the kids weren't, then I think we'd have given up the idea. Although they are only very young and can't really dictate the course of our lives. Although they obviously have for the last 10 years. but yes, so it is exciting. And I'm hoping for lots of visitors and new adventures. And there'll be lots of new stuff for us to explore and explore on the podcast as well.
And the thing is, we spoke about it the other day and you were saying, oh gosh, what if it's the wrong decision? But the brilliance is you're renting your house out for 12 months and you're renting that house for 12 months. And if it's not right, it's not right. And you'll learn. But I think you so want to go, you'd just regret it if you didn't do
it. Yeah, I think so.
And you can always come back.
I'm glad I'm in the position that we can do this as a kind of test, and that we have jobs where we can. I mean, we could go and try and live anywhere, to be honest. Actually, I would like to live in lots of different places, and I think to be able to move somewhere that's not too far from where we both have to kind of commute in for work. But because we don't have to be anywhere every day, we're very lucky that we can do that. And I think I do want some new challenges, and it is a challenge, isn't it, setting up somewhere else and making new friends and having new experiences and having a different view.
Yes.
And what could be better than a view of the sea?
And you've only got 55 years left, Sue. So you've only got 55 years
I
left.
I know. So. And if I want to live in Edinburgh as well,
yes,
Spain and Italy and probably Australia for a bit, then again.
Got to start now.
I better start now. So I'm starting with Brighton and Hove, and then we'll progress from there, really.
Where will you go next?
I think it'll be Edinburgh after that, once the kids have left home.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to live in Edinburgh for at least a year.
Edinburgh's on my list, actually.
Well, we can do that together. Yeah.
And I also really love Amsterdam and Paris, and I'd love to have to live in those cities for work.
I would like to live in Paris. Let's do it.
I'd love to live in Paris.
Esther, I believe truly, and one of the things about this move is that I truly think that anything is possible. And I think you've got to do things yourself. And it really has made me go, well, look, I want to move to Hove. Okay, well, let's move to Hove.
Yeah.
And we're doing it. And it's effort. There is effort involved. But my God, have I decluttered this house.
Oh, God, have you? Brilliant. I love a declutter.
I said, I love decluttering so much, Joel. It's actually sick.
It's freeing. It's freeing because you're letting go of stuff. It just takes time to sort
and
out.
And it takes your energy. I mean, yeah. Even looking at it. But did you know what? So much time has passed since I've had some of these things that I've decluttered that they mean nothing to me anymore. I don't feel like anything has to be permanent, really. Because we're not. Nothing is permanent. We're all going to cark it.
We are. And also, there's so many different versions of us. And we sort of shed a skin and then we come back as somebody else. I feel, I'm such a different person to the person I was 10 years ago and when I was a teenager. And whether that's just getting back to the core of who I am, or you're just learning and growing and having experiences. And that's what life is about.
It is. And also a desire for adventure and exploration. I think a certain amount of stability has to come with children, particularly, and depending on what your job is. But I think that there's always going to be a yearning for adventure in me and new experiences.
It's the stuff you don't do that you regret, isn't it? You know, depending on what it is. But for the most part.
So everyone listening, you know, you're more than welcome. Come down to Brighton and Hove and come sea swimming with me. And my purple hair and my tattoos and my extravagant earrings.
We'll have a party at your house, Suze. We'll get a date in the diary now. Everybody just come down.
I think of myself as a patron of the arts. I buy theatre tickets. Encore! I attend cinematic presentations.
Can I see some ID, madam? This is a 12 certification.
Oh, blast. And I adore a good art exhibition. Who's this by? It's just blobs.
Picasso?
Oh. But it's only now that I can call myself a true patron, as I've become a patron of Limited Time Only Podcast. My support enables Susie and Esther to make LTO the best it can be, and gets me bonus content and experiences I don't want to miss. I've just signed up for the first patron-only LTO live online. To sign up, go to patreon.com and search for Limited Time Only Podcast. There's a link in the show notes and in the LTO Instagram bio. I'll see you over there. I'm just off to the opera. Toodaloo!
Darling, thanks so much for coming in to discuss your wonderful new selfie-helpy woo-woo money spinner.
You mean my 120,000-page, meticulously researched book written to help women navigate the changes brought by middle age and stand up for themselves?
Have you quite finished? Love that you're giving a voice to women over 40. Oh,
thank you. It's a passion of mine to empower women and make sure they
I'm speaking.
Sorry.
Good. I want to discuss the title.
Oh?
Midlife Rises. Surely it should be Midlife Crisis.
Well, that's the point. It's not a crisis. Midlife is about rising up.
Women are too tired for that, darling. How about slow down, wake up?
Well, not really.
More wrinkles, less time.
That's just depressing.
You're old, no one cares.
That's plain offensive.
Menopausal, saggy and no fun. Middle age made easy.
What?
Who said that? Invisibility, over 40.
You're talking rubbish.
That's a good one.
Just no.
And another. You're on fire. Actually, that could work. Hot flushes, etc.
I've had enough. I'm taking my book elsewhere.
This is self-help, darling. Someone better than you advising you what to do.
And I'm advising you to take your advice and stick it up your ass.
Bit wordy, but I like it.
I walked across an empty land. I knew the pathway like the back of my hand.
I feel like I should have met you by now.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot about you.
Likewise.
Good. Well, I mean, I said to Esther, I was like, I'm so glad that you were up for doing it, because obviously you're massively busy with, you know, Keen and doing world stadium tours and things, and also with running your art centre and Mount Desolation, etc. But also, I know that you've been cooped up in a canal barge with my husband for an entire weekend, and you haven't held that against me, so I'm really grateful for that. So
I
thank
somehow
you.
Survived.
You're here to tell the tale.
He jumped off the roof when we were going under a bridge. He jumped from the roof of the boat up onto the bridge, ran across the bridge, jumped down back onto the roof of the boat on the other side.
He did not tell me that.
Was he naked? I feel like he might have been naked.
I wouldn't have been surprised if he had stripped off, but no.
I'm so sorry.
Today's guest is multi-instrumentalist, singer, songwriter, producer, and one quarter of the band Keen, Jessie Quinn. Coming from a musical family, Jessie began playing the drums from an early age, and at just 11 years old, performed in front of 20,000 people.
Jesse went on to form his own band, Jesse Quinn and the Mets, be part of Laura Marling's band, and become a roadie for Keen, before eventually becoming one of the band. Known for hits including Somewhere Only We Know and Everybody's Changing, Keen have achieved mainstream international success, and their 2004 album, Hopes and Fears, is one of the best-selling albums in UK chart history. We talked to Jesse about his bands Keen and Mount Desolation, the old Jet Art Centre that he founded and runs, and the confidence instilled by supportive parents. Welcome to the show, Jesse Quinn.
We've had so many questions from fans, Jesse fans.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
International. I mean, you've basically launched our podcast to the world.
From Brazil and Argentina.
Yeah, Argentina, there's Belgium, there's Canada. Yeah, Brazil.
Yeah,
so
cool.
Yeah,
it's very exciting. So, what are you up to at the moment? You're doing the world tour.
Well, we've half started it. So we've done four gigs so far. We did one in Mumbai, where I've never been to India before, which was wild and great fun. And we had Anushka Shankar came up and guested with us, which was really cool. And she was really nice. And then we went and did Cape Town and Joburg and. We did a charity thing for War Child in London. So we're gently starting. And then next week we go into rehearsals and we're starting getting ready to hit it properly. And we're the week after next, we're going to Mexico for a week and a bit. And from there, it's flat out for forever.
We're looking, where am I going? Right down. Going down to September, which finishes off in Boston. I know there's more. It says next. Oh, there's only the bottom of the page.
There's also loads that we haven't announced yet.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to be, we'll be busy until the end of the year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how are you feeling about it? Are you excited?
I've got mixed emotions. I mean, it's like any undertaking. You know, it's the thing that's exhausting about it is all of the flying and traveling. And touring is weirdly knackering. And you're living out of a suitcase, you know, every day. And I've also got old Jet to manage at the same time. And so it feels like a lot. But actually, when I think about it on a kind of day-by-day basis, then I'm really excited.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great fun.
It's that weird pull, isn't it, I think, as well, when you've got, touring, I imagine, just from doing productions and things like that, it's exciting. You want to be there. You love it. You're passionate about it. But then there's also away from your family, away from your partner, and as you say, it's tiring to do that.
Yeah, it is, and also you get that kind of you get this sort of midpoint lull quite often in a tour. So if you're away for 4 weeks, you know, the first week is quite exciting, the second week it's kind of like, right, we're into it now, and then you get in the middle, you get this bit where you're like, oh, we've only just got to halfway and it feels like we've been away forever. Because if you think about, like, you know, when you're at home, you think, oh, this week went so quickly all the time, don't you? Mm. It's because most of the time, the weeks that go quickly are the ones where your brain's not really given any sort of stimulation. You're just doing your normal routine. So it feels like time goes really quickly. But when you're touring and you have basically like a constant barrage of newness. Mm. So it's like when you're a kid, you know, time just completely slows down. And you can be like, I remember us doing a tour of America back in 2013, and it was January. We went out there on like the 3rd of January or something and did a whole month. And it was snow for a month. And I was like, honestly, when we got to the airport to come home, I felt like I'd been away for 6 months. It was extraordinary. It was fun.
It's nice, isn't it? That is a really nice way to look at it, like that experience of being a child. Because that's something we're all desperately trying to do, isn't it? Slow down time and that kind of mindfulness. But yeah, when everything is new and that excitement and you want to kind of hold on to things.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much we want to talk to you about. There's loads of different things about what you do and your experiences. I'm trying to kind of like work out where to start because I really want to talk about the experience of performing in a stadium specifically because that's quite unique. But I want to come to that maybe in a little bit because it'd be great to know how I love talking to musicians because I think what you do is kind of magic, really. And I know you probably don't feel like that. But how did it all start for you? Were you always going to be a musician?
My dad was a sound engineer and my mum is a singer. And so my dad, amongst other things, he was a cabinet maker by trade. So he used to build speakers for people and stuff. And because he was so practical, he did a lot of sort of site management stuff for festivals and things. So we used to spend every summer at this festival that he was the site manager of, the, our summer holidays, where we'd finish school, the day after we'd go there, and then the day before we started back, we'd come home. I mean, it was 6 weeks of basically being in a caravan or a tent. And that was completely normal to me. I was like, well, that's what summer holidays are. And we, you know, like he taught me to drive when I was nine, and I was sort of driving around the fields, collecting stakes as a job, and doing all these kind of mad things that kids don't normally do. You know, so all through my childhood, I was like, well, this is just kind of like what people do. And I thought, well, I'll be a musician. I started playing drums when I was seven, and I just sort of assumed it would happen at some point. It was only when I moved to London that I was like, oh, yeah, actually, there's loads of other people that want to be musicians, and it's quite difficult to get anywhere. It was only when I had kids that I suddenly felt like this sense of guilt that my kids had really boring holidays. You know, it's like summer holidays. So much of the summer holidays is just doing nothing. And I was like, oh, actually, that's normal. It's fine. It's just that I had like a weird upbringing where I was, you know, permanently away doing cool stuff, which was great.
Yeah.
I was really lucky. You know?
You were saying that because you were surrounded by that, you sort of felt that it was inevitable that you'd end up in music. Do you think that gave you a certain sort of confidence that you'd get where you wanted to go?
Well, I've thought about that quite a lot, because the thing that I feel is like a sort of strange, it's like a, you know, like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. I think where confidence is concerned, there's like a CBT thing with music where whatever you've kind of been pushed to do a lot of when you were younger, you feel confident at it. And then other things that you weren't, you don't. But it's all under the same roof. So it can be quite weird, but because I started on the drums, and my dad was a sound engineer and stuff, he was always, anytime there was a drum kit anywhere, he was like, get on the drums. And I was like, oh, Dad, you know. And so by the age of, I remember when I was about probably 11, I was still really young. I played on the main stage at this festival there was a guy who basically, he was just playing with a bass player. And my dad was like an opportunist. So he was like, my son plays the drums. He's really good. And this guy was like, well, we're only doing two songs, so you can join in. So I got up completely confidently in front of like 20,000 people and just joined in on the drums, which seems wild. But if you told me now, even with all my experience as a musician and touring, to just get up and join in on like lead vocals, I would be terrified, but I'd have no problem playing on the drums.
We talked to Roachford a few weeks ago, and he was talking about something similar, that he was surrounded by music, and then he was asked to perform, I think with his uncle, wasn't it, Suze? And he performed some gigs in London, and he wasn't very old, but because he was, and he was nervous about it, but because he was surrounded by it, he just did it. And I think, and also that trust that your dad put in you, like you play the drums all the time, get on the drums, get up there. Yeah. It's sort of that your dad trusts that you'll be all right. You don't see that anxiety in him of, oh, yeah. He's like, go on, up you get. And it's sort of,
yeah, get on with it.
Get on with it. Yeah. And that's quite, that instills that confidence.
100%.
Particularly at a young age when you're less aware.
Yeah, I mean, if you think, I mean, using music as a kind of example of it still, you hear about singers all the time who are like, oh, you know, especially like a lot of American black singers grew up singing in church, and they just have like natural confidence with their singing. It's like, oh, it's just singing. Whereas a lot of people are like, what do you mean just singing? It's terrifying.
That really resonates for me, because I get very panicky about singing.
Mm.
Whereas for me, if someone said, get up on stage and do this acting thing, I'll be like, yeah, okay, whatever. Or give me the words. Yeah, I'll say them. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But singing, I suddenly become really tense, because it's a big thing. You're getting up and do, but actually it's just an expression of something, and it doesn't have to be, well, it does when you're a professional musician, but the perfectionism around music is something that I think holds people back, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
That it has to be as good as that record you hear on the radio. Well, it's not going to be, because that's been produced to within an inch of its life.
Yeah. And I've had the fortune and misfortune of hearing a lot of those finished records while they're still works in progress, and they don't just magically appear either, you know, like even the, all of those albums like Pet Sounds or Revolver that are revered as kind of being the top albums, the best albums ever made, there were points in that creative process where they sounded like a dog's dinner, you know.
Yeah. And so you started your first band now. What was it? I want to say Benny and the Jets, but that's not right. It's Jesse Quinn and the Mets. And you were doing vocals, guitar and keyboard in that. So was that just the next step for you? Let's start a band.
Well, so I get easily bored. And when I was, so I learned the drums when I started when I was seven, like I said. And by the time I got to, when I started high school, I was like, oh, I want to be able to kind of flesh out whatever making music is, you know. So I started, like, my mum, obviously, like I said, was a singer, but she also played guitar and piano and stuff. So she had like a 12 string acoustic guitar, and I decided I was going to learn bass, which only has four strings. So I took all of the strings off her acoustic guitar except the four that you need for bass.
But she
like
that.
Oh, no. Fine. So I, from a really, I mean, I was, yeah, 10 or 11, actually, probably then. And so from a really early age, I was always trying to experiment and sort of expand my horizons with music. So, yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It's just, you know, creativity can be so many different things for so many different people. For me, it's, I sort of berate myself for having too many interests or being a sort of jack of all trades. And then you'll meet someone else that's kind of obsessive about one thing, like playing the trumpet or something. There's no right or wrong, really, is there?
Why do you berate yourself for that?
Well, I just think, you know, it might be better if I picked something and did it really well.
You're probably pretty good, Jesse. I think we can rest assured.
Compete.
You're quite good at it. Yeah. how did it come about that you ended up joining Keane? Because from what I've read, you were a roadie,
yeah,
on a tour.
Oh yeah.
And then what was it like? They were going, oh, he's quite good at tuning that guitar. I'll get it.
So I get asked all the time for some reason to talk to hashtag young people about creativity and like getting started in music, and I say to all of them, like, there isn't like a tick list of things to do. There is one thing that is above everything else, and I'm sure you both have experienced this in your own lives, which is communication and your relationships with people. So with Keane, it was one of those things where it was just a series of meeting one person and then they introduced me to another and getting on with people. So the long story shortened with Keane was that I met some of the roadies from a place I was working at. Then I decided to go freelance. One of them said, oh, we're doing the Keane tour. Do you want to come and be my production assistant? Which I went and did, and was just hopeless. Met the band, got on well with them, met the manager, Adam, and he said he found out that I was could sound engineer. So he said, oh, I've got this new artist called Laura Marling, who's a folk singer. Would you be interested in doing some gigs with her, doing sound? So I went and did gigs with Laura. I think I did two where I was doing the sound. And then one of her band left and she said, oh, will you play all of these instruments? Can you play and we'll get a different sound engineer? And I said, sure. So then, obviously, managed by the same manager as Keane, when they needed a bass player for something, Adam said, well, you know, Jesse's like shows up on time and brings a, like, is that enough?
Got his own guitar.
I didn't. The first time they asked me to do a Keane gig was at Brixton Academy, and they asked me to go and play Under Pressure by David Bowie and Freddie Mercury. And I had to borrow a bass to go and do it.
Wasn't your mum's guitar again that you'd tapped, yeah, apart?
I imagine, mum. Yeah, so it's all just meeting people, you know. And I think that's key to so many things in life where progress is concerned, just sort of being open to. I mean, it's not even really in a kind of like mean way. It's not like, oh, what can I get out of this person. I genuinely like enjoy meeting people, you know.
Yeah.
And somehow I'm still playing with them like 17 years later.
It's amazing. Yeah.
So there was no audition to get through. And I did that gig, and then they said, oh, you know, because they'd always had Tim, the keyboard player, had always played bass and recorded it. So they had to play along to that bass. They couldn't just kind of like, I mean, I can't stand the word, but they couldn't kind of jam. And so they were like, oh, if we have someone playing bass, we can mess around with the song structure, the keys, the tempo, all of that stuff really quickly and find out what feels right. So they asked me to go and do some pre-production on the recording for the next album. And that turned into the actual recording, that turned into the tour, that turned into 17 years of middle of the road indie pop.
Well, I bloody love it. I mean, actually, I was singing because I'm a big fan of Keane, and I was listening to some Keane's stuff in preparation for, and I was just singing my head off.
Oh, good.
And Joel came in and was like, I had no idea, and I was like, yep, no, I literally had. and it's funny because I think, well, I know this is before you joined, but then obviously you've played this and you will be playing it on this kind of 20th anniversary tour. But Somewhere Only We Know has kind of been with me throughout my life, and weird things like there's a young artist called Felix Mackenzie Barrow who is in a band called Divorce. We should check them out. But they're sort of picking up traction. They're doing quite well. And I remember when he was about, I don't know, he must have been about seven, and he was, and I was on tour. I was it was a company called Odd Socks Productions that his parents run, and I was on tour with them, and he was learning the piano. And he asked me to kind of simplify Somewhere Only We Know so that he could play it on the piano. Oh. So I kind of wrote out in very simple chords for him. But I mean,
you can't make it any more simple.
Well, I was going to say it's not massively complicated, but I think they were quite big chords.
Yeah.
So there's little tiny hand chords. And then a few years ago, when Beatrice, who's now nine, so she was about 3 weeks old, Joel and I did a community choir, pop-up choir thing in our local, where we lived. And we learned Somewhere Only We Know with this choir made of people. 3 hours we had.
Yeah.
We did it, four-part harmony, and then we performed it, and I was leading the choir for that. So it's just lovely. I mean, it's really, really cracking. So you came in, was it Perfect Symmetry?
Yeah, so that was the first album I worked on. Yeah, it was the third one, yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering about, because you talk about when you're developing the music, how does that work? And I'll be interested, how does Keane work, and also how your band Mount Desolation works as well, because that's another there's another different sound and different instruments, I think, involved in that.
Yeah.
But how you develop a song
with Keane? I mean, it's, well, so Tim is the songwriter in the band, and he's sort of got this conflicted, I mean, it's quite common with creative people. He'll sort of say, oh, he'll write a load of songs for whatever's going to be the next album. And he'll say, oh, they're all absolutely awful. And then he'll, you know, in almost the same breath, he'll be like, I think they're all the best thing I've ever written. You know? He sort of swings from one end to the other with it. So Tim writes the kind of the core of the song, and then basically it's a kind of like slightly rambling and chaotic process whereby he'll do a kind of rough demo, and then I'll add bits. We might try real drums. All of the songs start with Tim singing them, and he's got a great voice. I love Tim's voice, but Tom's voice is much higher. So Tim's probably a kind of high baritone and Tom's like a high tenor. So all of the demos, we have to get Tom to sing on the ones that we are feeling good about. And then we'll add loads of ideas, add Richard's drums, I'll add bass, and we'll keep working on that. And then in some cases, that's it. That's kind of like, it will get, because it's not like the old days where you kind of do a demo on a tape and then take it into a big studio. It's a bit more kind of, but sort of vague these days. So sometimes we'll get to the end of that process and it'll be like, well, that's great. Like Perfect Symmetry, although we did go into a big studio, was all self-produced. But then other times it's like, well, now it's time to get someone, get a grown-up involved. I mean, it's completely chaotic, but somehow it works.
And what about with Mount Desolation? Because it's you and Tim, isn't it?
Mm.
And other artists. Yeah. How did that come about? Were you not sick of each other?
No, I remember love working coming with up with other. That idea. And we were staying in this great hotel in Dublin where they have a sort of peat fire burning around the clock and Guinness and whiskey on, you know, like constantly being handed to you. It's a proper classic Irish kind of vibe, old school hotel. You know, with Keane, it's a machine. There's money involved. There are a lot of different people involved. There's pressure on it in terms of it being something that we can keep doing. So we're kind of thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great? And also with recording, the creative process, it's very piecemeal and like, you know, you'll do lots of bits at once and there'll be a big gap and, you know. So we said, oh, wouldn't it be nice to do something where it doesn't matter if anyone ever hears it and we just record it live, you know, and it's just playing and then it's done. So we thought, well, we'll do a whole album in a day and we'll make an album of like Hoedown Country. And we were going to call it My Dog Has Fleas. I don't know why.
That reminds me of a band name I came up with at school called Who's That Bold Guy? We never actually had the band. We just had the name.
It's not too late.
Yeah. No, I'll go for it.
Yeah. But so that was the premise of that basically. And Tim writes, so we were kind of writing, we write separately for that. And then what's quite nice is we sort of choose each other's songs. So I'll say to Tim, here's 10 that I've written. He'll say, here's 10 that I've written. And I'll say, well, I like this 5. And he'll say, well, I like that 5. So off we'll go. And then we've got our kind of like bandmates who are Fimbo on the drums, who I went to school with. We're in the same class. He's a farmer. He's agricultural in his playing style. He plays the drums like he's
I love that.
Driving a tractor. and Phil Renner, who plays violin and keyboards and a bit of guitar sometimes. Me and Tim and another really good mate of mine, Phil Scott, who plays bass. And it's sort of, and then we quite often will have Jess from the Staves guesting on BVs.
Mm.
Or,
you've got a lot of creative freedom with that, haven't you? Like Keane, as you say, the money's in Keane, whereas this is sort of more, let's just make some music and it doesn't matter what the end result is, as long as we're proud of it. We're not ticking any boxes for anybody.
Yeah. Although the only thing is, like, you always, whatever you do, you always want it to do well. And we've got low expectations of Mount Desolation, but we had one song on the first album that got a lot of syncs on American TV. And so we were like, oh, this is a great, you know, this has turned into a really viable, nice thing that we can do alongside Keane when we feel like it. But actually, that was fluke.
Oh, well, you've got, there are fans of Mount Desolation across
the... Yeah, that's what most of our questions are about, Mount Desolation.
Hey.
There's a poster, T-shirt, signed.
That's hilarious.
This is staying, this is good. We'll frame that. In fact, I wondered if, well, we have got some questions from Esther. Do you think now's a good time to ask?
Yeah, because we've got most of our questions are actually about Mount Desolation.
Really? Well, we've got, from audience, from listeners. Well, actually, I don't know if, I mean, I hope they're listening now. But I don't know if they were listening before. I think you've pulled them in. So Bella has asked, she says, hi, Jessie. Hi from Chile. And she says, I wondered what your favourite Mount Desolation song to perform is and also what the Mount Desolation song you're most proud of.
I'm most proud of the one that got all the American TV syncs, which is one of my
Which one was that?
It's called State of Our Affairs, but it's not.
That's my favourite one.
Is it?
That's my favourite one. Nice, yeah.
It's not that I even think that there's anything that great about it, but there's something about the production on it that I feel like, kind of like how I think I probably produce things at my most natural. So I'm really.
I love that one.
Yeah, I love that one too. It's great.
I felt it really when I was listening to the album. It really. I felt a real emotional connection to that. that made me, it sort of, I sort of felt connected in my gut to it.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder why that is. Well, there we go. I'm glad to hear it. I like playing Tim's songs the most live because I don't have to worry about the singing. I can just wig out on the guitar, especially Departure, which is another one from that first album, which is, we know it inside out, really, and it's and it's probably one of the ones the audience knows the best, so everyone sings along.
Oh, that's nice. Well, thank you for that question, Bella.
The next question is from Tro's Chest Hair. Thank you, Tro's Chest Hair. He or she, I'm imagining it's a he. I'm kind of hoping it's a he if it's chest hair. What was the inspiration behind the MTD song? The Mount Desolation song by the river. Also, how do you decide which Mount Desolation songs to sing versus which ones Tim sings? And lastly, to whom does the pink couch belong?
And they're in the States. It's chest hair is in the States.
They're in the States. Can't wait to see Keane on tour this September in the States. Lots of love to you all.
No. The pink couch, I don't know what that is. I can't think of a pink couch anywhere.
Is there a video or...?
Oh, maybe. Maybe it's in one of the videos. I haven't watched any of them for a long time. I'm sorry I can't answer that question. Well, Tim sings the ones he's written and I sing the ones I've written. Although there have been a few times when I've thought I'd sing one of his better than he sings it and he'd sing one of mine better than I'd sing it. But we've just never kind of gone for it. We should.
Next time.
A song's a song. It doesn't really matter, does it?
No.
But yeah, what was the other bit of that question?
The By the River. What was the inspiration for that song?
Well, I suppose it was about getting on with things regardless of how many walls you create for yourself with them. Just sort of saying, well, you know, it's so easy to give yourself lots of reasons for not doing something. So getting on with it regardless of those, basically.
I think I should I should listen to that song as my mantra.
Yeah, me too.
Question from Maureen from Belgium, who says, how is it for you to relive the Hopes and Fears era? Because obviously that's before you joined the band, but I mean, you've been playing with them for 17 years, as you say. But yeah, and she wonders if you have to play songs in the upcoming tour that you haven't played live before.
Yes.
You do, yeah.
And in fact, the ones that we're playing, some of the ones that we're playing live, the original bass was played on keyboard, but they kind of sound like a bass, a normal bass. So I've decided to play them on bass. Mm. But they're quite, some of them are quite fiddly.
You're regretting it now.
Yeah. It'll be fine. But I started out as a keen fan, so I, you know, like I remember, and also because I knew their roadies, we were kind of working alongside them. You know, I met them when they were just bringing out Summer in Ueno, and I remember like that song was the only song in the place that I worked at the time that absolutely united everyone. So we had like one guy was into like punk, one guy was only into like EDM. I was a bit of an indie kid. And whenever that came on, everyone was like, oh, so good. Because also, you have to remember that we were in the middle of that era of what they called landfill indie, where there was just loads and loads of spiky, sort of like the something indie bands. And it was getting a bit boring. Mm. And that came along, and it was like, oh, shit, this is really, you know, like, goes against everything else that's going on. And also, and the second album as well, I remember, like, both Summer in Ueno and Is It Any Wonder from the second album. I remember where I was and I heard it in my mum's kitchen and they were like, it's the first single from the new Keane album. And I was like, oh, I want to hear this. And I was so like, I mean, it's still probably one of my favourite Keane albums, the second one, which I had nothing to do with, but I just love it. I don't know. I just sort of feel like it's music and I don't really think about whether I played on the original recordings or not. The thing that's more awkward is when someone asks me to sign a copy of it and I'm like, well, I didn't have anything to do with it, so I feel a bit weird signing it, so I don't.
It's quite a thought though, isn't it, as well, to think of you listening to those albums and then if someone could just tap you on the shoulder and go, you're going to be part of that band in a few years.
I think about that sort of thing all the time, honestly.
Yeah,
you do. But like a good example is My wife, I met her when I was 14 and she went to the local boarding school and I just had an instant giant crush on her. And she was a year or two above me at this kind of posh school. And if you'd said to me, you know, we became friends, but if you said to me, oh, well, you guys will end up married with two kids living in Woodbridge or whatever, I'd just be completely, I wouldn't believe it. You know, I feel like life's completely and utterly rammed full of stuff like that. And generally pretty positive stuff. You know, I lost my dad 10 years ago. And that was, he was only 59. So that was really horrible and very sad. But I mean, with Keen, with just so many things, with Old Jet as well, if you told me, we're going to set up a weird art center on an American Air Force base, I just probably wouldn't have believed it. I don't know what I would have been doing instead, but anyway. Yeah.
Well, I'd definitely come to Old Jet. But there's one more question about Mount Desolation from Maria, who asks, has Jesse read any Patti Smith's books? And the reason why, because when I was reading Patti Smith, The Year of the Monkey, I thought about Mount Desolation's song, Dream Within a Dream, which Jesse sings. By the way, I love this song. It's what she says.
I did. Yeah, I did start. I should. I will. I promise. I love Patti. I actually met her once.
Did you?
When I was playing with Laura Marling, and I was still working at this place that did equipment hire and stuff. She was doing a gig at this church in London and I went down to take all the equipment and stuff. She was walking around this church while everyone was setting up and getting everything ready. And she had this big old-fashioned Polaroid camera. It was like black and white, took these little black and white rectangular photos. I don't know, I felt like weirdly not starstruck by her. But she just felt like a very natural, nice person, very approachable. And I said, I love photography and studied it at A level and stuff, and I said, oh, what's this camera, you know? And she said, oh, I take it on tour and just take photos and put them in this book. And she had a little hardback sketchbook that she was just filling up with these Polaroids. She was so nice, and I took it for granted a bit, but she's a bit of a legend really, isn't she?
Yeah,
she's a total legend.
Without rambling too much, I will recommend one thing for you, which is when she sang Hard Rain's Gonna Fall at Bob Dylan's When he won the Nobel Prize or whatever, and didn't turn up, she got up and sang, and she breaks down halfway through it. And it is, if push came to shove, I'd say it's the most powerful performance of music I've ever seen. I mean, it is mind-bogglingly amazing. And this orchestra gradually coming around her, and I thoroughly recommend it.
Well, anyway. I've written it down.
I'll check that out.
Yes.
Well, I love anything with an orchestra and when the string section builds and it's visceral.
Yeah, 100%.
So there's a few more questions, but they kind of go back to Keen a bit, which we'll come back to. But I would love it if you could tell us about Old Jet, because it's just fascinating. Kind of you're living my dream, basically. I've always wanted to run an art centre.
Don't.
Sorted. Shattered my dream. I'll move on.
That would be my tip. That would be my piece of advice. Don't bother. It's emotionally so rewarding. It's one of the things that I've done with my life that I feel like I can say was something that I've personally contributed to the world that's positive. And so I'm proud of it. I am proud of it. It's bloody hard work. It's like any business, you know, you're sort of like every time someone pays an invoice, someone else sends you one.
But
I set it up really as a response to kind of moving from London back to Suffolk. And, you know, there's lots of places in London where you get tons of studios in a big kind of converted warehouse or whatever. I think also at the time I was in London, I felt like I'd been living there very much in a sort of, with an attitude of collaboration all of the time, you know, where creativity was concerned. And when I came back to Suffolk, I was amazed. I thought I was going to be moving back to a sort of cultural wasteland, but I was amazed by the quantity of art being produced in Suffolk and the standard of it. And across the arts, music, visual, everything, writers. But everyone was working in isolation. I mean, it's an interesting thing, creativity, because unless you're in a band, most of the sort of creative things that people do are solitary. you know, mm. painter, if you're a photographer, all of these things, there's a sort of isolation that's inherent to them, which, you know, in some ways is kind of a cool challenge. But also there's a bit of me that thinks it's quite boring because you're only challenging yourself. And quite often we challenge ourselves in the worst possible way with, you know, unnecessary self-criticism and especially in the arts, I think a lot of people are very mean to themselves. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if I could put something together where a few people could come and have studios? And so that's what I did. And somehow, I don't know how it's managed to be a success, but it's our 10th year this year.
A few more questions because I've got to do the school run in a bit. But my lovely voice agent, actually, Michelle Daish, has said Hopes and Fears are one of her favourite albums of all time and would be on her Desert Island Discs. I don't know if you know even the answer to this, but what was the inspiration behind Bedshaped?
Oh, no idea. No. I mean, there's loads of Keane songs I haven't even heard yet.
He'll be playing them soon, live in the stadium, coming to you.
I'm sure Tim's talked about that one before, but
I'll Google it.
And Suzanne Bryden said, she would love to know, after 25 years of Keane, how do you feel about the world of music, in that how it's changed and how important live music is, its role now in the world of instant access and streaming, plus how do you feel having such a strong connection and bond with your audience?
That's a lot.
Well, in terms of like music and the music industry, I think it's in some ways the best it's ever been and in some ways the worst. I think in some ways it's the least sexist it's ever been and in some ways it's the most sexist. I mean, it's completely like, I don't know what's going on with the industry. As a maker of music, there are a lot of things about it that I find absolutely awful. But yeah, I mean, I could talk for hours about that, so I won't. What was the other bit of the question?
How do you feel having such a strong connection with your audience?
Oh, that's absolutely just dreamy. One of the things that I realized really early on with Keane was like, it was the first time that I was regularly playing in front of really big audiences. And you can quite often, if you're not careful, you can just think of them as a whole rather than as loads of individuals. And there's nothing better than when you see someone that's come to a gig on their own and they're just in it and they love it and they're just singing. And like, there's something really sort of special about that. It makes you feel like it's not just your ego up on a platform. You are actually doing something really meaningful. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've noticed in the last couple of years, I just think it's like probably my favorite thing in all of my time with Keane, my favorite thing to do with the audience and the people listening is that there are now people who were kind of at uni or finishing uni, you know, they were a lot younger, obviously, when Hopes and Fears came out. And then they've kind of had kids and stuff. And Keane has been their kind of like family musical common ground. So now we see families coming to the gigs where the parents might be in their kind of 40s or 50s and the kids will be in their teens or 20s. And, you know, say it's a family of four, they'll all be singing and you'll see them like hugging each other. And it's just like, it's lovely. We did a gig a year or two ago for a private thing. And this family, they you know, we had a real chance to sort of chat with them about it. And they were like, school run, holidays, going anywhere. That was what was on in the car. And it's been the thing that sort of like, you know, kind of galvanized the family in some ways. And seeing that is just like, oh, it's heartwarming.
That's lovely.
So special.
I would love to know what goes through your head when you're kind of, I mean, when you've played a massive stadium, what does it feel like when you've got thousands and thousands of people singing back at you?
It's really weird because what you learn almost straight away is that different countries and cultures have different attitudes to attending gigs. In Holland, we just thought for a long time, we thought Dutch audiences were a bit boring and didn't really do much. And a friend of mine who's Dutch said, no, we don't want to disturb the person next to us. We're being polite to each other. We don't want to jump up and down and scream and shout because it will ruin the experience for the person next to us. So now when we go to Holland, it's like, right, all of you jump up and down and sing and scream. And they do. And it's great. Whereas if you go to Argentina or Brazil or basically anywhere Latin, everyone's going completely wild. Every day is slightly different. And I never take it for granted.
When as actors and you perform a play and you get this massive adrenaline rush, I mean, you can be absolutely sort of dead on your feet like half an hour before and then you suddenly zing and you get this adrenaline. Yeah. I mean, in terms of a world tour, I mean, the amount of adrenaline you guys must be feeling with that enormous stadium and the sound and that must be quite a tiring aspect of it as well, kind of getting the rush and then
It's harder than you'd think, that side of it, because I feel like when we're on tour, if we finish a gig at 11, say, I really don't feel ready for
No.
bed until 3 or 4 in the morning. But I mean, it doesn't really matter because we don't have to be up early because the gig's not until the evening. But yeah, that side of it's quite interesting. And so I think there are a few good things to do with that if you're like performing in public. One is like to go and check the audience out and like get the feel of it a while before you're actually going on stage. Because if you just sit in a quiet dressing room, or you're in your hotel room or whatever, and then you just go out onto stage, it doesn't work. And I think quite often the gig or the performance suffers because your brain's too busy trying to process all of this sudden stimulation, you know. So I try and sort of like ease into it a bit, especially if it's like an arena or somewhere massive, you know. Also, you get things like, if you're standing in an arena watching a gig and they're doing like really fast flashing like strobe lights and stuff, we'll have bits where there'll be like red strobe lights. But if you're actually in the middle of them, it can be like a bit full on. I had a sort of meltdown in Mexico once. I think we were in Guadalajara, and we'd gone straight from our hotel room to this arena gig and back again. And there was like all these strobe lights. And I got back to the hotel and I was like convinced I was going to die. I was completely sort of like, and I don't have panic attacks or anything like that. It's not really my nature. But my wife was obviously back in England with our oldest then, sorry, our little baby. And I was kind of like looking at my watch, waiting for her to wake up, waiting so I knew I could call her. But I was absolutely in a state about it, you know. It's very
An
strange.
onslaught of kind of stimuli.
Yeah. You must have
Yeah.
experienced it.
Wow.
Do you prefer writing and creating with the band, or do you prefer being on tour?
Well, it's a bit of a shame that you have to be doing one or the other, really.
Yes. Yeah.
Have to kind of do 6 months of touring and then 6 months of writing or whatever. And really, it's nice to be doing a bit of both. We did a little mini album slash EP kind of thing called The Night Train back in like 2011, 10, something. And we recorded all of that while we were on tour. I don't think the end result was maybe as good as it could have been. It was really good, but like we don't play any of the songs live, apart from one. But it was great because we went into studios in like Australia and Germany and like all over the States, all over the place. And it was felt like we were scratching that itch, you know.
When you're playing and you're playing on tour, is that quite a good time to be writing?
Sometimes, I mean, I take a little case of stuff with me for demoing, like a couple of microphones and stuff, and we'll do bits and bobs. But also, you know, you're only each place that you go to, you're only there for an instant. So quite often you're trying to get the most out of it. Like if you're in Nashville for a day, you're not going to be like working on the
No.
demo. You're going to be like out there, you
Yeah.
know, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a bit tricky.
Yeah.
Bit easier if you're in England.
Yeah. In the old jet. Oh, but thank you
Yeah.
so much.
Asking me.
Oh my goodness, that was really fascinating.
Yeah,
And
lovely.
a lot of the things you said really resonated. And I will remember you saying about Tim going, "This is the worst thing I've ever written. This is the best thing I've ever written." I think you're right. I think that is a real creative's mindset, and it's a very weird thing. And it's almost like I'll say an idea, and at the beginning, I think it's a great idea. And by the time I've finished sentence, I've thought it was shit, and then I think it's great again. And it's like, it's just...
Let other people decide is my advice. Just do
Yeah.
it, and if people like, someone will like it, someone won't.
Just do it. Listen to
Just
that
do
song,
it.
and I'm gonna do it.
Yes.
So thank you, and it's lovely to meet you,
Yeah.
kind of on the Zoom, but we'll meet you in person
Yeah,
soon.
definitely. And come for a visit, old chap.
Thanks, Jessie. Bye.
You have been listening to Limited Time Only.
Thank you so much to the glorious Jessie Quinn for coming on our show and giving us your time. Again, we're so lucky, Suze, to get so many interesting, well, all of our guests have been interesting and fascinating, and we should do a night out with them all.
Oh God, wouldn't that be ace?
It'd be so
I'd love
amazing.
it.
Yeah.
It was great to talk to Jessie. You know, I'm a massive, massive fan. Massive fan of Keane. So that's made my week.
Made your week.
Made
That's
my
it.
week.
Suze is elated.
Oh, and it's just so nice to be back on the airwaves. in your ears. We've missed this, but it's been nice to have a little break, but it is very nice to be back. And we hope you've enjoyed this first episode, everybody.
Yes, we do. Thank you for listening, as always. Thank you for your support. And if you want to follow us over on Patreon, the full interviews are now going to be over there because we're trying to keep our episodes to about an hour. So if you want to listen to the full Jessie Quinn interview, that is over on Patreon. Just go to Patreon, type in limited time only. You'll find us. It's £5 a month subscription, and it helps support us and keeps the podcast going as well. Keeps us in your ears.
Yes, and you get all those extra minutes of our fabulous guests, and there is other bonus audio content and lots of other things as well. We've got plenty of things in the pipeline. There's also quite a few little videos over there that we've done specifically for Patreon patrons.
And occasional lives.
And we've got plans afoot for other lives throughout the year. But there will be another online Patreon only live very, very soon. So get on over to there, and we'll see you there and here. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another episode of the Pick Me Up in podcast form that is Limited Time Only.
Have a lovely fortnight, guys. See you soon.
Ta-ra.
Abyssinia.
Hey, girls, what are you talking about?